Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to TechTent, your weekly guide to all the hottest trends in the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we're looking at the man who can't stop making news in space with his reusable rockets, on Earth with his car firm Tesla, and now with a mission to hook our brains up to computers. Yes, we're going to be talking about Elon Musk. We'll also discuss a crucial week for Samsung as it launches the phone designed to wipe away memories of some recent disasters, and we'll meet a titan of the video games world. With me from the BBC Tech Desk is Jane Wakefield. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
Good to see you again. And my special guest is the technology journalist and gadget fan extraordinaire, Jonathan Margolis, who advises Financial Times readers on how to spend their sizable amounts of spare cash on the latest tech. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello, hello.
Good to have you in the Tech Tent. Here's a taste of what's coming up.
While there's a risk that this could all come tumbling down, I don't think that's going to stop Musk.
I give you the Galaxy S8.
First time I did it, I was in my office and I did forget where I was. It tricked me.
All of that soon. First, another landmark overnight for a tech tycoon with intergalactic ambitions.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Liftoff, South Carolina.
That's Elon Musk's SpaceX successfully relaunching a booster rocket that had been landed after another mission and landing it again on a ship. By doing so, he believes he's going to revolutionise the economics of space. Until now, rockets have gone up once and then been chucked away. But wait, there's been a whole lot more news this week from the tech tycoon. He's unveiled a new venture, Neuralink, which plans to implant computers into the brain to treat disorders or perhaps turn us into cyborgs. And his Tesla electric car business attracted the attention of the Chinese tech giant Tencent, which bought around 5% of the shares. That's meant that Tesla's stock market value has been edging up to around that of Ford. To put that in context, Ford has been around for 113 years and made over 3 million cars last year, while Tesla is just 14 years old and made 84,000 cars in 2016. I spoke to the electric car analyst and Elon Musk watcher, Nikki Gordon-Bloomfield, and asked her why Tesla was valued so highly.
It does very much seem that everything's moving towards Silicon Valley. And Tesla's obviously got the head start here because Tesla's being run like a software company, not an auto company. The big automakers, or the big three, they're all playing catch-up to Tesla in terms of vehicle technology, autonomous vehicle, and also, obviously, fuel train. They are desperate to keep the status quo. And I think the reason that Tesla is becoming as valuable as some of the big automakers is that it's willing to take those risks, and that's something that Silicon Valley investors absolutely love.
Is part of it the fact that he's so much more than just a car maker? We've had this extraordinary news about a new venture which will basically tap into the human brain. And we are in the middle of his latest SpaceX mission, boldly going where no such space mission has gone before.
Yeah, I mean, look, he is that kind of real life Iron Man, really. He likes to take big risks, and so far those risks are paying off. This new venture called Neuralink, you know, the idea that you can put computer chips into the brains of people who have ALS or other debilitating neurological conditions and give them back their lives. It is the stuff of science fiction, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's making such big waves, because he's willing to take those risks and willing to make those steps that no other people do. But the other thing that somebody mentioned to me this week is that Tesla and Musk and all of Musk's other companies are doing what they're doing because of the way that they are approaching problem solving. They're doing away with a lot of these traditional industrial age processes. SpaceX is a great example. The Falcon 9 rocket that has gone to space before, which is going to slash billions of dollars off the cost of space travel.
There is a chance, and some people say a good chance, that all of this will come tumbling down. He's constantly teetering on the edge of disaster, isn't he?
He is. Tesla recently closed a reasonably sized funding round in which Elon Musk purchased a large number of shares. Now, he has borrowed money up to the hilt to buy shares, and he's then going to sell those on in the future. So one of the reasons why he's a majority shareholder in Tesla is because he's borrowed a huge amount of money. And I suspect also that's helped inflate Tesla's market cap. But there are other companies now coming in. Tencent, which is Asia's second highest valued tech firm, has just purchased a 5% share in Tesla, which is, you know, phenomenal. While their risk is still very high, the rewards for these companies that are willing to take the risk, and China is willing to take the risk right now, is phenomenal. And while there's a risk that this could all come tumbling down, I don't think that's going to stop Musk. That's how he lives. It's how he lived at university. It's how he lived when he did PayPal. It's how he lived at the very early days of Tesla. Now, there was a point in Tesla's history where he had to write personal checks to keep the company afloat. And I think this is how Musk lives. He lives on the edge.
Nikki Gordon-Bloomfield on Elon Musk. Jane Wakefield from the BBC Tech Desk. It's another balmy mission launch this week with his brain plan. I mean, they all sound completely barking mad at first, don't they? But some of them pay off.
Yeah, I mean, everybody loves a colourful character, and there's none more colourful than Elon Musk, is there? I think his vision, modest vision, is to change the world and humanity. And, you know, frankly, at the rate he's going, he may well do. He tweeted in December that he hated the traffic in LA. A couple of months later, he'd started building tunnels at SpaceX headquarters to sort of try and create a whole new way of getting around the city. So this is interesting. His AI company, I think, is particularly interesting. I know it's set up as a sort of medical firm, but you can see it maybe playing into his fears about AI taking over the world when it becomes super intelligent. If you can create cyborgs, we sort of can equally take our place equally with the super intelligent AIs, perhaps.
Jonathan Margolis is our special guest. Are you a believer? Because there is a lot of hype around him, and his shares go up and then they go zooming down again, because quite often he's at least late in delivering on his products, and it's not clear that he's making much money yet from any of these things.
Well, who is in Silicon Valley? But I mean, I love the guy and I love the tech. I worry about the space thing because I'm very on the record as being sceptical about private space missions, because, you know, 5% of people have died in space. And whereas, you know, Red Army type people, NASA type people are prepared to take that risk, I'm not sure anybody, and I include Virgin Galactica in that, will really go into space. But the rest of it, I mean, Tesla is fantastic. I actually drove one in the early days and it's the most wonderful thing I've ever driven. Of course, it could be a problem if anybody ever invents a liquid fuel that could knock out electric cars. And the guy himself, I mean, he's a biopic in the making. It'll make the Mark Zuckerberg movie look really, really kind of dull and bland. He's a guy who, you know, gets married, gets unmarried, marries the same person the second time, divorces her a second time. And his background is fascinating. He was seriously bullied at school. I love this idea of him kind of employing the bullies to wash his car, like in Back to the Future and Biff.
Yeah, he's gonna give us plenty of colour for years to come on Tech Tent. You can be sure of that. Now, for the world's biggest mobile phone maker, it has, to say the least, been a trying few months. First, the Samsung Note 7 had to be withdrawn after it showed a tendency to overheat and catch fire. Then the firm's boss was arrested and charged with corruption in a bribery scandal which has rocked the South Korean government. So a lot was riding on the launch of its new flagship device this week.
I give you the Galaxy S8 and S8 Plus.
That's how the new device was announced in a typical smartphone launch in New York by Samsung's mobile boss DJ Ko. But will it work the trick? And is this latest phone really more innovative than anything else out there? To find out more, Tech Tent's Zoe Kleinman spoke to Samsung's Jean-Daniel Aim from the company's mobile division.
We have taken a much larger screen than we would normally and put it in a smaller form factor. So we have created a phone based on the Infinity display that naturally blends into the design, enhances the viewability and the usability of the phone and the immersion of the experience you can have with your smartphone. A great camera, a great interaction, a fantastic Quad HD Plus screen, and a beautiful design.
Obviously, the Note 7 has been a painful experience for Samsung. What have you learned from that journey?
We took a lot of lessons on the battery, and we have implemented new types of control, new quality insurance processes that we are, of course, implementing in the production of the S8 and the S8 Plus, but not only, in all our phones. So all our manufacturing process have benefited from the experience we gained through this painful experience.
Let's talk briefly about Bixby, the digital assistant that is new to this phone. Can you tell me a bit about it?
So Bixby is a new way to interact with your phone in a more easy, more contextual and a multimodal way. Multimodal meaning different ways to interact with your phone. You can ask Bixby to take all the pictures you have taken in London today and show them to you in a much more natural and quick way than you would do with your finger and send them to my wife, for example. I could tell to Bixby, for example, Bixby, I don't want to be disturbed for the next 2 hours. And Bixby will automatically understand me and put the phone in do not disturb mode for the next 2 hours.
Let's talk about the battery. You've got a bigger screen, a more powerful phone, but not a bigger battery in this model.
We have a smaller phone, actually. So the Galaxy S8 is actually narrower than the Galaxy S7. So we are constrained with the size of the device. And we have made all the efforts to make the perfect integration of all the components. So we have the biggest battery we can put in this kind of phone.
Do you think that customer feeling about the brand of Samsung has been damaged by everything that happened last year?
We have actually witnessed a lot of faith and a lot of loyalty in our customers. And we want to give them the insurance to reassure them that, first of all, this will never happen again, but we learned this. And not only did we learn, we made the community benefit of this because we created this advisory board of the battery experts. We created this 8-point battery check that we have released to everybody. So we want to make the industry move forward, not only with what happened, but with the next generation of devices.
Jean-Daniel Aime from Samsung's mobile division there. Jonathan Margolis, has that brand been damaged? I mean, it was a huge disaster, wasn't it, the Note 7? We all wrote about it a lot, got very excited about it. All the while, Samsung has continued to sell other phones and its share prices continue going up.
From when I look around me in, you know, different cities and towns, it seems that the public are pretty hot on Samsung. I mean, it's the one phone you see as much as an iPhone wherever you go in the world. They're very, very beautiful phones. But my problem with the whole smartphone race now is that it's really kind of over. I mean, when somebody's trying to explain that Bixby is just slightly different from Google Assistant, fractionally different from Siri, I mean, there comes a point when who cares?
They don't need to try too hard anymore, you're saying. And they and Apple have basically won the smartphone.
They've won it. They've done it. Now, what Apple do when they have to do their version 8, which, I mean, if I were Apple, I'd say we're not going to call it a phone anymore. We're going to call it a computer or something, because it's not, nobody makes phone calls anymore. Somebody has to put new life into this battle. And what can Apple do other than, you know, curve the screen around a bit just like a Samsung? They hate following Samsung, but they've kind of been forced to. The other problem is people are keeping their phones for longer because they're really very, very, very good machines now.
Bixby, though, they're making a big play of this AI assistant. Are those, we've been hearing about them for a long time, Siri's been around for a long time. Are they finally beginning to make a difference to the way we use our phones?
For me, they're all as good as the information that's put into them. I, on the way to the studio here, I needed to find a pharmacy. So I asked Siri to take me to the nearest chemist. And it told me about somewhere called Brooks Pharmacy, close to here in Broadcasting House. What it meant was Boots Pharmacy, which is much better known than the non-existent Brooks Pharmacy. So that's a case where garbage has gone in, garbage comes out.
We still need to make a bit of progress on making our virtual assistants really that useful, it strikes me. You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, we'll meet the man behind the legendary video game BioShock. First, though, let's look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Jane Wakefield. Jane, a big row over privacy in the United States. Congress voted to do away with restrictions on the way internet providers can use customer data. What's this about, and how are opponents of it fighting back?
Yeah, so this is rolling back on a rule which said that internet service providers had to ask permission from their customers before they sold browsing data. They will be able to do that now, but it's likely it will be anonymised. And in some ways, it just brings ISPs, internet service providers, in line with firms such as Google and Facebook, which already do that. But it has generated lots of anger on Twitter and a couple of crowdfunding campaigns, which have promised to purchase the internet history of all legislators, members of Congress and their families in protest. The only problem with this is that there's another law, the US Telecommunications Act, that prohibits the sharing of individually identifiable data. So they may well raise a lot of money, but it's unlikely they will spend it on gathering politicians' data, sadly, yes. Perhaps.
Yes, I'm sure we'd all like to gather politicians' yes. data. And Amazon's made a big purchase in the Middle East this week.
Yes, so it's bought the region's biggest online retailer, Souq.com, which is commonly known as the Amazon of the Middle East. We don't know how much it spent, although estimates are that it was worth at least $650 million. And it will, of course, give Amazon access to the lucrative Middle East market, where surprisingly online shopping has yet to truly take off. There are 50 million customers in the region, but only about 2% of all its retail is made online.
Amazon marching on there. And IKEA, the Swedish furniture giant, the latest entrant into the smart home business.
So we all own something from IKEA, right? And now it looks like we might also own some smart things that IKEA are going to do. It's offering a range of smart lighting that can be controlled via a smartphone app and suitably low prices. Well, if you think $18 for a smart light bulb is cheap. It's also offering motion sensors so that when you go into a room, the lights will come on and when you go out, they'll go off. So the smart house hasn't really happened yet, but IKEA coming in might change that. And the fact that we've now got these assistants like Google Home, which is coming to the UK next week, and Amazon's Alexa, we all need something for these assistants to do. And turning on the light bulbs is one thing that they can do.
I happen to know that Jonathan Margolis has got strong views on this. You're not that impressed by being able to tell your house to turn on the lights.
No, I made myself very unpopular this week by pronouncing, after many years at looking at smart houses, the whole thing is childish and silly. it came about, the moment came for me when I got a switch to switch on all my side lights. I love that kind of Hygge Danish look of having side lights and no centre light. So there's 11 side lights come on with one switch. And my son, who's a big Nest kind of fan and smart home fan, came around. I turned the lights on. He said, "My God, how did you do that?" And I said, "With a switch?" And he was terribly impressed by that. Now, I've been looking at smart homes for longer than anybody on earth. 1987 was my first smart home in Tokyo. And it was rubbish. And
you're not convinced that this all chat with these voice assistants. You don't want to walk in and say, "Alexa or Google at home, turn on the lights."
They just get more complicated. I've got a Hue set up at home, and it takes longer to turn it on from Alexa than it does just again to turn the switch. So I've got a Hue light bulb costing hundreds of pounds, whatever it was, which I just turn on with a switch, and it's better.
Jonathan's rejecting years and years of advances which have allowed us, instead of flicking a switch with our hands, to rummage through a smartphone and do the same thing. Is he right? Let us know. At BBC Tech Tent is our Twitter account, or we've got a Facebook page too. Now, the video games industry is at a very exciting stage in its development. After the smartphone revolution introduced a whole new audience to games, along came another new technology, virtual reality, to shake things up again. In London this week, a 10-day games festival has got underway, starting with an event called Rezzed. I went along to take the temperature of the sector and to meet the creative legend behind a great game series. Now, this is an event which puts video games developers, big but mainly small, in direct touch with their audience. The place is filling up with hordes of mainly young gamers who've come here to try out all sorts of new titles, everything from virtual reality to educational games to traditional shoot-em-ups. And they get the chance to chat with the very people who've made these games. So wandering around, we've now come across a virtual reality game. Ryan Hale, your company's behind it. Tell us a bit about the game.
Yeah, so Giant Cop is pretty much what it sounds like. You're a giant police officer patrolling the streets of Micro City.
There's been an enormous amount of excitement about virtual reality over the last couple of years. Is there a danger that this has peaked?
It hasn't peaked yet. You'll see it peak when the hardware gets a little smaller and a little less expensive and maybe not tethered to a computer, so it doesn't need things like lasers to track where you are and that type of thing. The technology hasn't caught up to where people want it to be yet, so people like Oculus and Facebook are actually working on a self-contained unit, and lots of other companies have been working towards that goal as well.
Well, this event has attracted one real star of the gaming world, Ken Levine, creator of the legendary BioShock series. He told me that for all the talk of new technology, games are about one simple thing: storytelling.
As a writer, you know, I come from a writing background, so character and setting have always been the most important things to me. Placing the character in a world and having them interact with great characters. I think when you look at, like, you see all the cosplayers around, for instance, you see people dressed up like the characters. I feel that the gaming audience is no different than any other audience in the sense they want stories, they want characters, but they also want an experience they can participate in.
Now, the big new technology development of the last couple of years in terms of the games world has been the amount of money invested in virtual reality, and we're now seeing some of those platforms come out. Is that exciting to you, or is it a bit overhyped?
So right now, to me, it seems it's an experiential thing more than a gaming thing. Like, it puts you in a world. But it really, I remember the first time I did it, I was in my office, and I did forget where I was. Even though I was very conscious that, you know, what was going on, it tricked me. And for a moment, my brain kind of forgot. And that's a very powerful experience. Like all things, you know, these things take time to get right. I don't know as a gaming platform whether it's there yet or whether that's the best thing for it. But, hey, I'm totally won't to be surprised.
We're still waiting then for the first great VR game. It needs a huge hit.
Like on the AR side, you know, the augmented reality, you know, you saw something that, like Pokemon Go that came out, where the application was, well, it had a lot of advantages. Everybody had a phone, right? It got people out of their homes and into the world, and that just sort of, that's a moment of a killer app sort of coming along and saying, you know, whether it had necessarily the legs that other games might have is sort of secondary, but it clearly demonstrated the potential power of something very quickly. I think VR is still waiting for that, and I'm sure it will come. I just, you know, it just hasn't happened yet.
That's Ken Levine, not convinced that VR is here yet in games. Jonathan Margolis, briefly, are you?
I love VR. I prefer it for kind of videoing news and stuff like that, which I think is the exciting bit, and drama and so on, but I'm not a big games fan, but this was also a big week for the gaming industry in that I bought my first computer game since Caterpillar in the 80s, and I bought FIFA 17, and I'm playing and replaying Nottingham Forest versus Derby, and I finally managed to get a goal passed, and then I realised I was playing on the amateur level.
Other games are available, we should stress. We've run out of time. Thanks to Jane Wakefield and to my special guest, Jonathan Margolis from the Financial Times. And you can read more about technology stories at bbc.com/technology. Remind everybody, all your friends about our podcast, and please join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.